A focus on the specific aspect, what we could call, of the Bali HaMasorah, right? Our whole theme this year is talking about Masorah, and so we've developed a lot in terms of understanding what it was that we received at Sinai and what that meant in terms of how it developed over the generations. But now we want to talk about what Masorah tradition actually looks like in terms of a chain. Where do we fit into that Masorah? How does it come about? So we have four different color-coded items to make it easier to track today. And let's begin, as Stephen Covey, Zichron Levracha, said, let's begin with the end in mind. So let's start with the blue sheet, which I'm not going to be able to vouch for the historicity of this document. It's from a nice website called simpletoremember.com.
Wow. That's amazing.
But this is a really interesting look at a development, at a Masorah. It starts on the top left column from Moshe Rabbeinu. We're going to go through the list of people on the left-hand column a little more in depth. The middle section is primarily the period of the Gaonim. Most of these figures are not known to me, and I can't speak to their identity. But if you move to the bottom of the middle column, you meet someone who is well-known to us.
Rashi.
Rashi, once you hit Rashi, you'll be able to follow all the way through from Rashi till the bottom of column number 3. And there you meet our kolel today.
There you go.
And I put in my particular 3 Bali HaMasorah, the people from whom I have learned. When we pass these back to the fellows.
So I'm just surprised there's an inconsistency, because all these are names. And then the last one, it should be like base Reuven or something.
What do you mean?
Instead of why you
oh, right.
But see, should base Reuven.
I was going to put my name, Reuven Brand, but yeah. It's a little bit, you know.
Yeah. It's not yourself. I'll just talk it out.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So that's why I put these specific 3 individuals who are my Rabbeim. So now we can start from the bottom of the blue page, So I had the privilege when I was in Israel, when Nachum and I were first married, we learned in the Grus Kolel, and that was where I had the opportunity to learn from Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Levracha. And then when I came to Chicago, having the opportunity to spend quality time, Yibod L'Chaim Tovim V'Aruchim, with Rav Schwartz Shlita, and Rav Schechter, of course, before, when I was in the Smicha program, when I was an undergraduate. These 3 great Bali HaMasorah were students of Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. And Rav Soloveitchik was a student of his father, the Gaon Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was a student of his father, the Gaon Rav Chaim, from his father, the original Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, from Rav Chaim Voloshiner, from Rav Itzel Voloshiner to Rav Chaim Voloshiner, to the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon's father. And you go all the way back, and you can start to notice, you'll pick out, if you become familiar with these figures, how you can actually trace Rebbe to Talmud, teacher to student, all the way back to Moshe at Sinai. So that's kind of the goal. The goal is for us to appreciate and understand how we get from Moshe Rabbeinu to us. That's our goal. That's what we're going to try to accomplish. And to do that, we're going to look at the Rambam, who's apparently spent some time and thought that this was very important. So we're going to now go put the blue sheet away and just look at the packet, the regular weekly packet cover. It's right here. Jump right in, Paul. No worries. So if you look, I started with the packet cover. This is a Ripley's, believe it or not, for people who are from Chicago who are older than I am. Does anybody recognize this? This advertisement on the front page of this. Anybody recognize this company? Or it must be really, really not so well known. Anybody recognize this? The Visking Corporation? Anybody even know where West 6733 West 65th Street is?
Yes. Midway. Yes.
Okay, where is that? I don't even know, honestly.
Near Midway Airport.
Near Midway Airport. So this is an advertisement from a publication which we're going to talk about a little bit. So I put it there as a trivia question to see if anybody ever heard of this. This was a hot dog company, a kosher hot dog company in the 1940s in Chicago, called the Visking or the Visking, I don't even know, casing. Quality, protection, purity, and service. Near Midway Airport. So we're going to come back to why this is relevant to us, Bechlal. So let's turn to page 1. We'll come back to that. They didn't make the salami? I think they called it the casing company, but it seems like from the advertisement, from the rest, which I cut off, it seems like they advertise they have the most delicious hot dogs.
It's already in my
there, no, it sounds like it's a real hot dog company. So this is the first introduction of the Rambam. This is the introduction of the Rambam to Sefer Mada. And the Rambam begins telling us what he's going to teach us, which is all the mitzvahs of the Torah. Kol ha-mitzvos shenitnu lo l'Moshe b'Sinai b'firushan nitnu. All the mitzvahs that were given to Moshe were given with their explanation. And remember, many weeks ago when we started this journey, we talked about how Moshe got the written Torah and he got the oral Torah with the five components and all the pieces of the puzzle. And the Rambam says, now I numbered it on the right side with the numbers, you see 1 through 13 on the bottom. So he says, Afal pi shalom nechtav ha-Torah shebal peh. Even though the oral tradition was not written down, Lamda Moshe Rabbeinu Kula Bevezdino L'Shivim Zekenim, Limda. Moshe Rabbeinu taught it within his rabbinic court to the 70 elders. Ve'elazar, I'm on line 3. Ve'elazar Upinchas, those are the two Kohanim, and Yehoshua, Shloshtan Kiblu Mimoshe, the three of them. His three chief disciples were Elazar was his nephew, Pinchas was his great-nephew, and Yehoshua was his student. Uliyoshua, Shu Talmido Shel Moshe Rabbeinu, Masar Torah Shebal Peh V'Tzivo Aleha. And of those three chief students, there was one special student, one standout, who was the chief arbiter of Torah Shebal Peh, and that was Yehoshua. V'chein Yehoshua, Kol Yumei Chayav Lomar Al Peh. He learned everything by heart. It was Moshe Rabbeinu teaching it to him with nothing written. V'zekenim Rabim Kiblu Yehoshua, and many Zekenim received it from Yehoshua. Where do you find that phrase? Yehoshua l'Zekenim? That's right, the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Rambam is drilling down to give you a much clearer understanding of what we're saying. Yehoshua l'zakenim means Yehoshua taught it to many elders. I'm on line 7. V'kibel Eli min hazakenim umi Pinchas. Eli, the Kohen, received it from these zakenim and from Pinchas. Ushmuel kibel me Eli. Shmuel, remember, was the young man who was Eli's protege, who lived in the Beis HaMikdash and in the Mishkan. He was Eli's chief disciple. Unfortunately, Eli's sons went off the way, so Shmuel took their place. Shmuel received it from him. V'David kibel mishmuel ubeis dino. So Shmuel received it from Eli and his bezdin, and David received it from Shmuel and his bezdin. So you have the singular figure, that would be the one chief Baal Masorah, and he had a bezdin that went with him. The Zekenim, the elders that were grouped together with him, the Rambam says. Va'achia hashiloni miyotzi mitzrayim haya, v'levi haya, v'shama mimoshe v'haya katmi meimoshe v'ukibel midavid u'bizdino. Fascinating. According to the Rambam, Achia hashiloni, who was an important prophet, was one of the yotzi mitzrayim. He must have lived an incredibly long time. We could do the math of exactly how long he lived from Yitzias Mitzrayim until David HaMelech. Must have lived a very long time. The Rambam says he was a young man. It's an interesting tidbit. You know, if someone asks you on a plane when you're traveling somewhere, you know, can you tell me somebody who left Egypt, who was there at, you know, at the time of the building of the Beis HaMikdash, the fundraising for the Beis HaMikdash? You would say, yeah. Either Pinchas Ze Eliyahu, one option, or Achia HaShiloni, who the Rambam says lived for an enormously long time. So he was a young boy, and he was a Levi, and he heard from Moshe as a kid, and he received it from David and Bezdin. So it's interesting, Achia HaShiloni had the childlike memory of what it meant to see Moshe Rabbeinu, but he didn't learn anything from Moshe Rabbeinu. He was a kid, and it probably was, I don't know, playing in the backyard with all the other kids. But he lived a very long time, and he took over, he received it from David HaMelech and his Bezdin. Eliyahu, last line number 13, Kibel Me'achila HaShiloni U'Bezdino. So Eliyahu, top left column, line 14, Eliyahu HaNavi, he received it. But notice how the Rambam here, I'm still on page 1 on the top left column, the Rambam here does not make a mention of the fact that Eliyahu was a Navi. And this, the Rambam discusses, we alluded to it once in the Pirush HaMishnayos, where the Rambam points out that the role of the Navi is not to be confused with the role of the Chacham. The role of Achiah HaShiloni, even though he was a great prophet, probably the greatest prophet of his era, but his role in this process of the transmission of the Torah was not a prophetic one. It was a human one. He was a Chacham, not a Navi. Eliyahu HaNavi was the great prophet, but that's not relevant to us right now. What's relevant to us right now was that he was a Chacham. So he was a bearer, a standard bearer of the Torah Shebaal Peh. He received it from his Rebbe, and he's going to pass it along. V'Yehoyada HaKohen Kibel Me'elisha U'Bezdino. You remember there was a very righteous Kohen Gadol. He hid the king, the boy King Yoash in his closet, and he was responsible for upkeep, and he renovated the Beis HaMikdash when it started to fall into disrepair. And who got it from him? From Zechariah got it from Yehoyada U'Bezdino. Line 17, V'Hoshea Kibel Mizchariah, V'Amos Kibel Mehoshea, V'Yeshayahu from Amos, Micha from Yeshaya, V'Yoel from Micha, Nachum from Yoel, Chavakuk from Nachum, Tzfanya from Chavakuk, Yirmiah got it from Tzfanya, and Baruch Ben Neriah, who was his chief disciple, he got it from Tzfanya, line 21, U'Baruch Ben Neriah, line 22, from Yirmiah, Ezra Bezdino from Baruch, and line 23, Bezdino shall Ezra heim hanikra'in anshe Knesset HaGedolah. The Bezdin of Ezra, they refer to the anshe Knesset HaGedolah, then they are Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, Nehemiah, Mordechai, Zerubbabel, and other Chacham. So this is the tradition all the way from Moshe until the anshe Knesset HaGedolah. There were 120 members of the anshe Knesset HaGedolah, which is why there are 120 members of the
Knesset.
Right, Knesset. So these Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, so they're living at what time? So who's on this list? Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi is the end of the Nevi'im, end of Bayis Rishon, beginning of Bayis Sheni. They rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash with Ezra and Nehemiah, the people who came up from Bavel. Who else is on that list? A notable name for the next holiday we're going to celebrate? Mordechai. Mordechai is on this list of the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah. So now you could put this all, stage one, from Moshe until the end of the prophets of Anshe Knesset HaGedolah. You could put it on your mattering map in your mind if you take out the off-white page. Take the off-white page. We had a fellow from the Kollel years ago. His name was Rav Chagai Elitzur. Some of you remember him. His grandfather wrote the Tanakh. Remember, his grandfather was the Yehuda Elitzur, the great scholar, who was the editor, one of the editors of the Das Mikra. So Rav Chagai once put this together, and I saved it, and I asked him if I could keep using it in the future. If you look on the top half of this chart, he puts the timeline here. You see the first chunk from Adam to Noach, approximately the first 1,000 years, and then from Noach to Avram, 1948, until the Avos and Shibud Mitzrayim. When do we leave Egypt? Kabbalah HaTorah, 2448. So I'm on the Hebrew side, where the blocks are on the top. So now this is where the Rambam is picking it up. He picks it up in 2448, when Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah. He's going to pass it on to Yehoshua through the period of the Shoftim till the Malachim and the Nevi'im. And you see how the Malachim and the Nevi'im overlap. But the Nevi'im that the Rambam mentioned, like Tzfanya and Hoshea, they're not playing the role of the prophet. They're playing the role of the Chacham. So you're going to carry the Torah, top line, Kabbalah HaTorah, David, Churban Beis HaMikdash, Shiva Sion, Purim. So this is, although there is some ambiguity exactly when Purim happened, but assuming that Purim happened somewhere right before the rebuilding actual of the second Beis HaMikdash. So now you have taken us from the year zero till the year Tzigazin, to the year, 3300 or so, 3500. Nice chart you put together.
Why didn't they teach us this in elementary school?
Yeah,
we had no clue about the That's ridiculous.
We have no clue sitting here.
This is what, so I try to do this for my own kids. Sometimes my son will come home and say, well, he learned something about such and such. I'll say, do you know when that person lived? So usually he's off by about half a millennium. Usually. But he's only in eighth grade, so there's hope, I guess. But to me, this is very important, because otherwise I really don't, you know, and it's going to get more important as you get more contemporary, because when I'll ask my son if he knew the difference of when Rav Moshe ben Maimon and Rav Moshe Isserles lived, and of course he doesn't know either one, so then the whole story doesn't really make any sense. Like, you know, if the Rambam said something and if Rav Moshe Feinstein said something, you can't really weigh those two opinions because you don't really understand where they fit. You know, how do you figure that out? So you have to understand the whole development of when these people lived and when the periods of time are. So this takes us to the Ajik Nesis HaGdola. So maybe the answer to your question, Barbara, is maybe they did teach it to us and we forgot it, or maybe they didn't. I don't know.
They didn't teach
it. I don't know.
They did not.
Yeah.
It mentions on the first page some things were written down. Do we then take from that that other things are just transmitted by mouth?
Okay, so good. So let's go back to the Rambam. Go to page 2 for a second so we can address Elaine's point before we go any further. So we started by saying that the Torah Shebichtav was written down, the Torah Shebaal Peh was not written down. And Moshe Rabbeinu taught it to Yoshua exclusively orally. So going back to the white packets on page 2, on the right-hand side where the letters are, this is the next page in the Rambam, letter A. Umimos Moshe Va'ad Rabbeinu HaKadosh. From Moshe until the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, give or take around the year 230, of the Common Era, when the Mishnayos were edited, the Rambam says on line B, "Lo chibru chibur shemalamdim oso berabim b'Torah shebal peh." They never put together a written document from which they would teach publicly. Some of you will remember we once quoted a Gemara in Gittin that says that Dvarim Shebal Peh, the oral tradition, is Iyatar Rashai Bechsav. You're not allowed to write it down. So what the Rambam says is what, in his opinion, what that meant was you were never allowed to teach a shir like this, where everybody has source packets and I have notes and everybody's learning together, where I'm teaching from a text. That would not be acceptable. What happened, the Rambam says, go to line C, Elosh b'chol dor v'dor, every generation, Rosh Bezdin, O Navi, Shahaya, Sheyia ba'oso ador, the prophet, but not in the role of the prophet, Kosev la'atzmo zichron, the person themselves would write notes. To remember, they would write their own personal notes. Either b'shmua sheshame me'rabosa, the teachings that he heard from his rabbeim, v'hu melamed al-peh barabim. But the experience of teaching did not involve the notes. So he may have kept notes for himself, but it wasn't a shared document that they passed on from generation to generation. Until the time of Rabbeinu HaKadosh. What happened? What did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi create?
Mishnayos,
exactly. Which was a written text that became uniform. That was the skeleton, you could call it, of Torah Shebaal Peh that was being passed around. That was written down in manuscript form, and everybody was teaching it. So the Rambam says, "V'chein line F, v'chein kol echad v'echad kosev le'atzmo kafi kocho mibir haTorah mil choseh." Everybody would write for themselves as much as they're able from the explanation of the Torah, k'mo sheshama, like they heard. Umidvarm shenischad shubuchol dor v'dor bedinim shalolam du mepiashmua elavinas shloshes v'midos shivizgim alein bezna gadol, and all the new innovative laws and interpretations that we spoke about over the last couple of weeks about the Yud Gimel Midos, comparing different things and applying different halachos and looking at it fresh in every generation. All those things they wrote it down until v'chein haya line J. V'chein haya hadavar tamid. That's the way it was until Rabbeinu HaKadosh v'ukibetz kol hashmos. He, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, gathered all the teachings. V'chol adinim v'chol abirim v'apirushim. Top left column now. Sheshamim m'moshe v'arabenu v'shalom dubez n'shol kol dobrador v'chol tarakula v'chiber me'hakol me'hakol sefer ha-mishnah. And he put together the Mishnah. Why did he do this? The Rambam says one simple reason. Because of the unfortunate consequence of the persecution. And the diaspora left with no choice. Right? What's happening in the year 200? So you're on the heels of the Hadrianic persecutions, you know, the Asar Haruge Malchus that lasts about 150 years from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash through the destruction of Beitar, 2nd century, Rabbi Akiva, other martyrs, and the Jews are fleeing. The Chachamim are fleeing from the north of Israel, which is where the center of learning was in the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. They live near Tveria and Tzipori. That's why for people who like to go grave hopping in Israel, if you want to go grave hopping for the Chachmei HaMishnah, you don't look in Yerushalayim, because there were no sages left in Yerushalayim. They had all moved to the north. So if you look around, Meron and Tzfat, these places, that's where all the Chachamim lived. But it was essentially, by that time, by the year 200, it was the beginning of the flight. People were going where? Where were they going, the Chachamim?
Babel.
That's right. They were going to Babel. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi sees all the students, that there's terrible persecutions, no one's going to stay. And what's going to happen? The Torah Shabbat is going to be lost. So he said, this is what we need to do. We're going to build a little skeleton, because if you learn Mishnayos, if you only learn Mishnayos, it's a great thing. It's a very important thing to learn Mishnayos. For those who are interested, you know, learn one Mishnah a day or one Perek a day. If you learn one Perek a day, you can learn all of Shas Mishnayos in a year and a half. Now, you don't have to understand everything, but over the course of doing it a few times, you get a little sense of what's going on. But if you learn Mishnayos, you know, you really don't know anything, because you only know the skeleton. You have to know the Gemara to understand what the source of the din is and what the applications of the din and what the parameters of the din are. All these things. But it's a good memory device. Especially because a lot of people in the times of the Gemara, they used to learn the Mishnayos. They used to learn it with the tune. So if you learned all the Mishnayos, if you know A, B, C, and D, the halachos, the facts, Rabbi Yehuda said this, Rabbi Meir said that, well, we also are going to remember, and we'll discuss in the shir, and we'll all learn together, we'll all turn to each other and say, oh, do you remember what the reason for that was? Well, that's the halacha. Well, maybe the source was something else. Well, I'll quote you a pasuk, and within that, you know, it also reminds me of a story that my Rebbe told me, that Moshe Rabbeinu told his, you know, back and forth. What is that description of? The Gemara. Right? The Gemara is the full amplification of the Mishnah. So you learn the Mishnah, so that's a skeleton. And then you learn the Gemara, and then Ravina Ravashi of the Sofo Ra. So if you look back on our off-white chart, so here, from the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, that's where you pick it up in the beginning, for example, of Pirkei Avos. Right? What does the first mission of Pirkei Avos tell you? That Shimon HaTzadik was from the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, of this kibbutz of Chachamim, and then he passed it along to the pairs, the Zugos. So the Zugos, you see, they take you all the way from Shimon HaTzadik, from the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. The Zugos, also called the Tanoim, these are the period of the rabbinic sages of the Mishnah, all the way until you get through the Malchus of the Beis Chashmonoi, which was a turbulent period. At the end of the Malchus Beis Chashmonoi, you see in the section on the bottom, you have the family of Rabbi Gamliel, who are descendants of Hillel. Hillel was, I guess you would call him, the last of the great Nisim, the last of the great chief rabbis. Because after that, the period of the Zugos fall apart. Hillel and Shammai, remember, wait a second. Hillel and Shammai, what was significant about them and their students? What happened, what started with the Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel? What did we discuss? Machlokas, right? So not only are Hillel and Shammai the last Nasi and Avesin, that's also kind of like the last major centralization of learning, because now with their students becomes a huge proliferation of machlokas, differences of opinion. But that family maintains a prominent leadership role. So if you look on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side you see how it splinters, which we'll talk about in a second, but on the right-hand side in the block boxes, it's Hillel, his son Reb Shimon, his son Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein, the famous, very important, titanic figure of Mishnah, who is a very strong centralized leader, who's living at the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. You see on the right-hand side, you're going from, in the blocks, it's Malchus Beis Chashmonai to Churban Beis HaMikdash, going down his son Reb Shimon, to his son Gamliel, to his son Reb Shimon Gamliel, living at the time of the destruction of Bar Kokhba, Reb Yehuda HaNasi, and then his son Rebbe Gamliel. So this is the family, direct father-son on one side, the rabbinic, I guess you would call them, the dynasty. But on the left-hand side, you see a lot of names. those are the rabbis of the Mishnah after the period of the pairs, the Zugos. Right? The Zugos period, you had Shmaya and Avtalion, Hillel and Shammai, you had two. But now it becomes much more decentralized, and that's why you have so many names in the Mishnayos. And they go from generation to generation. If you look on the left side of the chart, you see it says door one, generation two, generation three, generation four, and generation five. Once you hit the fifth generation, you hit Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and then all the students scatter. Most of the chief students go to Bavel, and that's where you have the Talmud Bavli, but some of them stay in Eretz Yisrael, and you have the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi, because it is in Eretz Yisrael, has more of a Greek influence because of the neighborhood, so the language is different than the Talmud Bavli. If you ever read Yerushalmi, and you're not experienced in reading Yerushalmi, I'm not very experienced in anything, certainly not reading Yerushalmi. It's very hard to read the Yerushalmi. The language is different, the syntax is different, because it's written, A, in a different neighborhood, in a different culture, but it's also written in a different style. Because the number of students were smaller, and the intensity of the persecution cut down the whole experience of learning. And that's why it was edited much earlier. It's not as comprehensive, and that's why it's less authoritative. So it was edited about the year 3-something, but I don't remember who the final editors of the Yerushalmi were. It's a great question. I should look it up. I don't remember.
It was around the time of Elisha ben Avuya also.
Elisha ben Avuya is, go back to the chart, he was a teacher of Rabbi
Meir.
So look here. He's around the third generation, so he's earlier. He's going to be around the year 100 of the Common Era, around the time of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva lived at the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash in the year 70. After the year 70. But the people who lived through the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was one generation before him. Who was that? That was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Right, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai with his famous stories with sparing the Chachmei Yavne and escaping from Jerusalem. So Elisha ben Avuya is going to be in this generation around Rabbi Akiva, the third generation. See, halfway down that chart on the left side, earlier. And then we're going to move on to the Bavli.
So I just got one question. This is very interesting because this is just on today's daf, I think. Rabbi Akiva. Was a student of Rav Nachum Ish Gamzo.
Yes, you see.
Literally
him
there.
Yes.
So the question is, where did he come from?
Great. So I'm sure he came from somewhere. I don't know who Nachum Ish Gamzo's teacher was. There is, on the other side, you'll see a chart. Don't turn it over yet. We'll get to it in a little bit because it's very complex. I'm sure there's somebody who knows a lot more than I do who knows who the teacher of Nachum Ish Gamzo. I don't know
who it
was.
Or maybe just don't refer to
it. Right. It could be he was anonymous. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But they all fit in here somewhere.
Yeah.
And each one of these people, if you go through them one by one, you'll find that there is a lot to say about each person. You know, Nachum Ish Gamzo comes from the famous teaching.
Gamzo
right?
Latova.
Gamzo Latova.
But that's what I found so fascinating, because they talk about non-related machlokas totally, but Rabbi Akiva, who's always the optimist, like
yes,
at the end
right.
of Makos. You know, he's laughing, they're crying. And I thought it blew my mind. And it was not related to anything about happiness or sadness, just a side of my thoughts about Ribui, me at Ribui.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, it's Reb Nachum Ish Gamzo. Well, that's why he must be an optimist.
Exactly. And that's, it fits because the Gemara tells a story. Rabbi Akiva was once going to somewhere to take a trip somewhere. And I guess, I don't know why nobody knew who he was, but he came to a town and nobody invited him in. So he didn't have a place to sleep. So he went out to the edge of the town and went to sleep in the forest. And Umar describes that he had with him a chicken. I guess that was going to be lunch tomorrow. He had a chicken, he had a nair, and he had his mattress. I guess he slept with a sleeping bag in case he didn't have a place to sleep. You can imagine Rabbi Akiva came to your town, he didn't have a place to sleep. So Rabbi Akiva's sleeping in the forest, and he says, okay, I have no place to sleep. His teacher was Nachum Ish Gamzo. He says, Gamzo Latova, no problem.
He says that.
Yeah, he says
Rabbi
it's fine.
Rabbi Akiva says that.
Yeah.
He says Gamzo Latova.
He says fine.
Well,
no worries.
Yeah.
In that context, the fact that his teacher was Nachum Ish Gamzo. I think it's Gemar and Brachos somewhere.
Yeah.
And then the wind comes and blows out his candle. He says, no problem. It's also okay. Gamzo Latova. And then a fox comes and eats the chicken. So he says, Gamzu Latova. So he goes to sleep. He doesn't have his candle, so he can't learn. He doesn't have his chicken, so he doesn't have breakfast. But he goes to sleep. In the morning, he wakes up, and he sees that there's a plume of smoke coming from that nearby neighborhood. And he sees that it had been raided by marauders who murdered everyone in the neighborhood and lit the place on fire. So Rabbi Akiva says, look, if I would have been sleeping there, I would have been killed. And if my chicken would have been making noise, I would have been found out. And if my light would have been on, they would have seen me. So Gamzu L'tova. So Rabbi Akiva was a terrific optimist, and he wasn't. And so there are people who are great scholars who look at this, and with this, they could take it to a whole nother level. They understand, wait a second, why is it that one shita follows a certain approach? Well, if you see it on a chart, and you see that Sumchus was a student, you don't see it with a line, but Sumchus was a student of Reb Meir. So at one point the Gemara says, one of the Tanaim said, don't let Sumchus in here. Don't let Sumchus in. Why not let Sumchus in the Beis Medrash? What was wrong with Sumchus? So Rashi explains, well, Sumchus was a student of Reb Meir, and Reb Meir was extremely sharp. And the Rebbe in the shir, he says, I don't want anybody hacking the Chinik in the shir. I just want to say a simple pshat. I don't need Sumchus driving me crazy. Because he learned his methodology of learning from Reb Meir. And I think it was Reb Yehuda, who was an interlocutor commonly of Reb Meir. He says, I don't want Reb Meir in the Beis Medrash. I don't want him in the classroom. Let him go learn somewhere else. He doesn't need to hack me a Chinik. But the point is that there was a tradition. Reb Lezer ben Orkanis, he was a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but he was also a student of the Beis Shammai. It's a lot more complex. This is oversimplifying the story. But now you can understand why, A, in his deus, in his shitus, very often Reb Lezer is not accepted. Reb Lezer ben Orkanis is not followed, often halacha l'maisa. Because if his tradition comes from Beis Shammai, wait a second, we don't usually pass him like Beis Shammai, so his tradition is usually not accepted. But you can also understand why, in a certain sense, he picked up, I don't know how an English word to say this, but he picked up the Stolzkeit of Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai was extremely strong in their opinions. So what happens when the story of the Tana Shalachnoi, this specific oven, comes up in the Gemara Bava Metzia? Reb Lezer bangs on the table and he says, if the halacha is like me, the river should flow backwards. And if the halacha is like me, the wall should cave in. He was very stark. And perhaps he connected to the approach of the Beis Shammai. Right, so last time we spoke about the role of machlokes and the different opinions, but when you see it on a piece of paper, you could see how the different approaches follow through. And also, there's a fellow, I never met him, but I saw one of his farms somewhere once. I think his name is Rabbi Nachman Cohen from Riverdale. His life work is to go through all these different people and figure out how all their shittas fit together. You know, you can go through Shas, you can find like 25 machlokas between Reb Elezer and Reb Yeshua. So he points out that is not just an accident. That there, remember we spoke about the origins of machlokas of having a different methodology of learning? That there are different methodologies kept playing out between the two of them. Every time they encountered a different sugya, they always looked at it differently. But it was the same difference of opinion, the same core shita that just played out in different sugyas. And it's the same Reb Meir and Reb Yehuda. Reb Meir and Reb Yehuda, they're always arguing because they must have had two different ways of looking at any given issue, and every time there was another issue, they had two different ways of looking at it. So this takes us until the end of the Mishnayos. Turn the page over. And now you have, this comes from Aryeh Carmel, from a little book that I had when I was in 8th grade called Aiding Talmud Study. Those who have kids who are in day school, sometimes they buy these, they recommend them for the kids. A great, like, simple chart where he also goes through. Right, well, somewhat simplified. At least it's visualized before you. The right-hand side is your Amuroi of Eretz Yisrael. He says Rabbi Mana is the conclusion of the Talmud Yerushalmi. You see where the timeline is on the right side? So 350, Shlitas HaNotrim. When is that? What are you talking about? You're talking about when the Roman Empire becomes the Roman Empire that adopts Christianity. And that is the end of the Talmud Yerushalmi, around that time. So, who are the great sages? Look on the right side, in the middle section, Rabbi Yochanan bar Nafcha, he lived in Tveria, so his interlocutor was Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish, and he has students, Rabbi Elezer ben Pedas and others, Rabbi Abo. So Rabbi Yochanan is living in Eretz Yisrael, and you see on the left side he has these students, Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, and others. Well, when Rabbi Yochanan is teaching Torah, Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi are living in Eretz Yisrael, they're learning from him. And they have students, if you go further down, Rabbi Yochanan himself has students, Rav Dimi and Ravin. You see, I'm around the year 300, Rav Dimi and Ravin. So Ravin used to travel a lot to Babel. So Ravin would come to Babel and say, Kiyasa Ravin, when Ravin came to Babel, he told them what he heard from Rabbi Yochanan in Israel. It's a direct tradition. Rabbi Yochanan's teachers were Rabbi Yanai, Rabbi Chia, and Rabbi Oshia, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. It's a direct tradition. It's not a fairy tale. It goes back to the blue sheet that we started with. You can trace it. You finish the Tanoim, you move on to the Amorim, and it's a direct handoff. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, in addition to Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia, who were his students slash colleagues, his other students were Rav and Shmuel. Move to the left side of the page. Rav and Shmuel have to leave Israel, and they go to Bavel. Rav gets Smicha, which is why he's called Rav. His name is Abba. And Shmuel was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's physician. We mentioned that once. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi had his personal physician, Shmuel, but Shmuel never got smicha. But he said, it's okay. He went to Bavel, and he had a lot of teachings from Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And he set up the other center. There were two major cities. If you look in the parentheses, under Rav and Shmuel, Rav was in Sura, Shmuel was in Naharda, and Rav had three major students, also shared with Shmuel, Rav Huna, Rav Yehuda, and Rav Nachman. There was a third major city, look in the middle, Rav Yehuda, he lived in Pumpadisa. So if you were looking in Bavel for a place to learn, you either learned in Sura, in Naharda, or in Pumpadisa. These were the three major centers. And you see different people move there, and they learn there. And so it continues from Rav Huna to his student Rabba, to Rabba's students Rava and Abaye. Abaye was actually a nephew of Rabba, which is why his name was Rabba. Abaye's nickname was Nachmeni because his uncle Rabba, who raised him, was Nachmeni. You see, by the way, the circles here are the wives. Rav Nachman on the second line, around the year 300, a little before, on the left-hand side, Rav Nachman, he was an important dayan. His wife, his name was Yalta. Yalta appears many times in Shas. She was a very big character. She had a lot of personality, and she comes up a lot of times in Shas. There's a lot of stories about her. She was an interesting person. And then if you look down to the next generation, Abaye's wife, her name was Choma. She also comes up in Shas a couple of times. And Rava had a wife. His name was Bas. Anyway, these are real people. We should take like a half hour for everybody to take a deep breath and like we can analyze it. But it just gives you a sense that there was a direct connection from one generation to the next, all the way, go down to the year 450. Ravina and Ravashi. Ravina and Ravashi, the Gemara says, are Sofora. They are the end of the Talmud. So this is the end of the period of the real development of the Torah Shebaal Peh, from Moshe Rabbeinu until Ravashi.
And they organized the Gemara, right?
And yeah, Ravina Ravashi edited the Gemara.
That's where they put it.
So now go back to the Rambam in the white packet. Go to page 3. And here the Rambam lists now. The Rambam lists. You see on the right hand side in line 1. He says, from now I can tell you, Nimtza, it's found, Meirav Ashi ad Moshe Rabbeinu Arboim Ish, the Elohim. These are the 40 names of the individuals, these specific men, the Chachmei HaMasorah, who will take you from the end of the Gemara all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And he goes through them, you see each one. Ravina received it, Rav Ashi got it from Rava, from Rabba, from Rav Huna, Rav Yochanan, Rav and Shmuel. That's the period of the Amoraim. So we saw that. Rav and Shmuel, they got it from Rabbeinu HaKadosh, from Shimon, his father, from Rabbi Gamliel, his father, from Shimon, his father. We saw all these people. Go back, keep going back. Let's go to step 12. Shmaya and Avtalion, Yehuda and Shimon, Yehuda and Nitai, Nitai Harabeli, Yosef and Yosef. Now we're in the period of the pairs, the Zugos in Pirkei Avos. From Shimon HaTzadik, number 17, step 17, who got it from Ezra, from Baruch, and then all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So far, so good?
Sure.
So now the question is, why is it that the Rambam thought it was so important to write down these names?
Give credibility.
Right. Okay, authority.
That's number one, because you can
right.
say it went all the way
to that's right. It's got to be credible. You know, we tell our kids, I was in one of the classes the other day. I happened to be in a class with a group of students in the academy. And, you know, one of the great things about the Kollel, Baruch Hashem, is that we have the opportunity to interact with a lot of different students. So this past week, we had an entire school-wide program with all the students in the Fasim Yeshiva High School. And then we've been breaking down all the academy students to get programs with them. So one group of students, I was in this group, and we're talking about a particular issue in Halacha. So the kid says to me, well, how do you know that the Torah is really from Sinai? And it's a fair question from a 10th grade student. How do you know that the Torah is from Sinai? So there are tons of proofs. You can go to a seminar, Eisha Torah and Discovery. They'll prove to you the Torah min Hashemayim, the Torah is from Sinai. But I'm not such a smart guy, so the proofs, sometimes they go over my head. I said, I'll tell you something simple. The proof is that we know that it was passed down. We have names of people. I can show you the names. I can tell you who my Rabbeim are. We'll take it all the way to Rashi. I can show you, the Rambam will give you exactly the names. It's not fairy tales. You open the Tanakh, you see these people. It's real names, it's real people. You just follow one to the next. And so we need to reinforce for the kids that it's not Stam, you know, it's a fairy tale that we say that we got the Torah at Sinai. How does the kid in 2017 know that we got the Torah at Sinai thousands of years ago? Well, if you can actually put it on one piece of paper, it's not so theoretical anymore. So I said, I don't know what to tell you, except that what works for me is to know that there is a direct unbroken chain. So there's a question of credibility here that the Rambam thought it was important for us to know. Yeah, what were you going to say?
But I'm still concerned about the telephone. It wasn't written down. Still say maybe someone missed something in translation.
Great. So this goes back to an important point that Beth is pointing out. Wait a second. What about the telephone piece? But if you remember, this is only half the story because the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, was being passed down by a group of scholars and being checked through the Masorah method that everybody had their parallel, you know, text to check across from the other. And so even today, in all the Tanakh, how many are there? The slightest variations, just a handful. So let's bring it together now. So the Torah Shebichsav, that's going to be the backbone of everything that's being taught. How does that fit with the Torah Shebaal Peh? The Torah Shebaal Peh is the pirushin, the interpretations, and the traditions that go with the Torah Shebichsav. So the Aruch HaShulchan pointed out, he says that we have almost no arguments about the core issues. So what's interesting is that even though you have so many different telephones, you don't have anyone who ever said that a pre-Eitz Hadar on Sukkot was a plum. Right? There's an internal connection and an internal system of integrity that's being maintained even through the period of the Machlokas. So it's not the case of telephone where, you know, maybe one person misheard it and then the next person misheard from them and then misheard from them. Because everybody is focused on maintaining that original core tradition. And this was their life's work. And this brings us to maybe the second point, which you're alluding to, which is, well, wait a second. What is special about these people? Or maybe there's some other reason where the Rambam wrote this down, not just for the historicity of it, to make sure that it's historically accurate, to know that these are the people. But there's another added component here, and this is why I put the hot dog advertisement on the cover, because this is a special Chicago shout out on the next page, on page 4.
Rambam called out Chicago.
Well, not exactly, but Rob Soloveitchik. Here you go. So you are looking at the cover of a Torah journal. You see the date of this journal, February 1944, volume 17, number 11. If you wanted to find this man,
Independence Boulevard.
1220 Independence Boulevard. You can call him at Rockwell 3290. Okay? People know exactly where this is. Whose journal is this? This is known as the Hapardes Journal. Why is it called Hapardes? because the editor of this was Rav Shmuel Aaron Halevi Pardes.
$3 a year.
Was that a lot of money at that time?
What you focus on.
So here you have the HaPardes Journal, a rabbinic journal that was published in the 1940s. This was one of the most important, most prominent rabbinic journals, and it was published right here in Chicago on Independence Boulevard.
Where'd you find it?
So this is a well-known, this is a very important journal, and you can get access to this for free on HebrewBooks.org. You can get dozens of issues of HaPardes, and they have a lot of important chidushim in the world of Torah. A lot of news. You know, they have announcements, you know, whose Rebbetzin died and, you know, who's sitting Shiva. They also have essays in Halacha. It's a very important journal. They also have advertisements, which was what was interesting to me on the cover. So the first of all, you see on the right side, they have a Yiddish advertisement for Horowitz, Margaret, and Matzah. And in the back, they have an advertisement in HaPardes for the hot dogs. I guess if you're interested in Rabbanus and you're hungry, so you might order hot dogs. So in this edition of HaPardes, turn the next page. You have a supplement. A supplement to HaPardes. Mimosfe HaPardes. Words that were spoken. Look at the bottom. Divrei halacha va'agada shenemu b'makelos am. Words of halacha and agada that were spoken in a gathering of people al yaday. Harav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik Ish Boston. From Rav Soloveitchik. Yom Shabbos Kodesh Parshas Baaloscha Tov Shin Gimel. The Beis HaKnesses Anshe Brisk, Brooklyn, New York. So Rabbi HaPardes says that Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, delivered a drasha, an incredible drasha. In the summer of 1944, the third yahrzeit of his father, the Gaon Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So he's publishing this, actually it was before, but he's publishing this in 1944 on Yom Erev Shabbos Kodesh Parshas Bo Gimel Shvat Tav Shin Aleph. So Rabbi HaPardes summarizes a talk that the Rav gave in a shul called Anshe Bris. I didn't do enough research to figure out what was the shul Anshe Bris. But this was a talk that Rav Soloveitchik gave in Brooklyn that Rabbi HaPardes got a hold of the notes of, and he published this so that everybody in the Olam HaTorah, everybody should hear this shiur that Rav Soloveitchik gave. And it's an incredible shiur, which we're going to skip most of. The shiur is about the Rambam's opinion of Shitas, the Shitas of Rambam in Hilchos Kiddush HaKodesh. It's not for today. But in the context of that, Rav Soloveitchik has a chiddush about the nature of Masorah and the people who the Rambam lists. Go to the next page on page 6. All right, we're running late. I apologize. He says, Upa'amim Rabos. Many times. Left-hand column, beginning of the paragraph. Here Tzisi Lefne Abba Mari Hagon HaChasid Tzatzal. He says, I, Yashaber, said this to my father. Who is his father? Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He says, I told this to my father and he liked this pshat. So I'm going to tell it to you what I told my father. If you want to talk about Mesorah, you're holding onto a piece of it right now. This is what the Rav says that he told his father. And my father praised what I said. And he, Rav Moshe, said it over in his shiur. What I said, the Rav said. This is the best yahrzeit thing I could say for my father, is that he said over this shtickle Torah that I said his son. Amazing. Ki midivrei HaRambam muchach. It is clear from the Rambam. Shemasora, that tradition, mahavachaloshem bifnei atzmo. That's a rare, brisker terminology. Chaloshem means the effect of a name. It has a category. It has legal standing bifnei atzmo, independently. Ve'eino rak din ne'emonos ubirur. It is not just for the purpose of clarification and birur. and what you said, credibility. Rav Soloveitchik says a chiddush, he says, my father liked this chiddush. The people who are on this list that we enumerated, that the Rambam named, they are there not just for clarification purposes, but for something else. They have a special halachic standing, said Rav Soloveitchik. And he says, let me explain it to you. And in classic Brisker tradition, he says, there's two dinim, two aspects. Break it down into two components. Venira, and it seems, de be'ikar shel amitas Torah shebal peh, in the truth, the source of the truth of the Torah shebal peh. Remember who's speaking here. This is a man who himself is perhaps one of the greatest conduits of Torah shebal peh, the Balei HaMasorah that has been seen in 100 years. So he's speaking about what Masorah means. Shtei halachas miyuchados. Aleph, number one, dechachmei HaMasorah mimoshe ve'elach, that the sages of the Masorah from Moshe and on, ne'emonim, they are trustworthy, limsor es haTorah shekiblu miSinai. They have credibility. The Rambam gave them sanction. This is what you're talking about in piece number one. They're not stam people. They're authoritative figures. And therefore, they have a hashkacha. Ne'emonim, they are trustworthy. Limsor es haTorah shekiblu miSinai, v'Torah shebal peh, hametsuya achshav biyadeinu. The Torah shebal peh that we have now, he osa haTorah shenitna l'moshe b'pi haGevurah. That's number one. It's not telephone. These people have been checked. Baruch u'menusa, as you would say. That's number one. But now there's another level. There's another significance to the names of these people. We have to know who they are. That's why the Rambam spent 3 pages telling you a list of names. Beis, the etzem haKabbalah, the actual receiving of this tradition, ein rak ma'isa bira b'fnei atzmo, ein rak ma'isa bira ba'alma. It's not just a statement, an act of clarification. Birur means to clarify. It's not just that. Ela mahava chaloshim b'fnei atzmo al mesorah v'kabbalah. What does that mean? The Torah shebal peh, nitna lehimaser. It was by design created to be passed from one generation to the next. Lehi maser, to be passed over. Shenitna lehi kasev, just like written Torah was supposed to be written, the oral Torah was supposed to be transmitted orally. V'atzma shel Torah shebal peh nitvas b'mesorah, kamo zu shebichsav, b'chsiva. Ula almita shel davar, and for the truth of the matter, limud u'mesorah, shnei dvarim hema, nifradim hema. They're two different things. Limud, learning, ainu rak bir, it's not just clarity. U'mesorah havei halacha b'fnei atzmo. Chutz din limud, the Torah shebal peh nimseres b'chalos shem mesorah mirav l'talmid api halacha. There is an aspect of the definition of the oral tradition. Meaning, you need to maintain the facts of the oral tradition, but there is also an idea, an entity, a spiritual thing called the tradition. And that tradition has rules, just like the written tradition has rules. The written tradition has letters, has statements, it has paragraphs. So the oral tradition has a corpus of tradition, and that's going to be shepherded from one generation to the next. Moshe Rabbeinu had many students, but only one of them carried the mantle of the concept of Torah Shebal Peh. And that was Yehoshua. Right? He had Pinchas and he had Elazar, but only one. Go to the next page, page 7, the following page.
But don't you think that the other students also passed it along, even
yes,
though they weren't given that?
Of course, absolutely. So that's why the Rambam is telling you, that's why Rav Soloveitchik is saying that there are two things you have to know. There are lots of students and there was a lot that was being passed on. But there was only one student who was given the authority and the responsibility and the nod to the formal passing along of this tradition. So everybody was learning. And that's why Rav Soloveitchik says, the Rambam was careful to note, Moshe had 3 chief disciples. Why did the Rambam tell us he had 3? Because they all learned from Moshe and their opinions were all important. But at the end of the day, there has to be one final authority. So he says on the top, Hutzrichu litlos maise, lachalos maise mesorah bal peh l'shem mesorah v'kabbalah. U'mesorah zu niskaima ayde Moshe l'Yehoshua bovad. And u'pinchas huchrach l'kabbalah satorah odapam Yehoshua. Kedei L'mosu L'achirim. Pinchas had to be the next chain, he had to get it from Yehoshua. Because there are two aspects. There are the factual aspects of learning. A lot of people learn. But then there is the spiritual special dimension of this Torah Shebaal Peh. And that's why Moshe says, go six lines down in the quotes, V'tziv sa'oso le'enehem. You have to command Yehoshua to their eyes. Yehoshua was given the Torah Shebaal Peh as this special quality. And therefore, the Rambam, and Rav Soloveitchik says, this is why the Rambam in the next paragraph, in Ilchos Tshuva, second line of the paragraph, V'chein ha'kofer b'firusha, v'hu Torah Shebaal Peh, v'ha'makchish magideh, k'gon tzarek u'baitas, kol echon mishlol she'elu kofer b'torah. Wait a second, it's a little bit unusual. A person who denies the explanation of Torah, and that is Torah Shebaal Peh, that is the oral tradition. If you reject the oral tradition, so then you are a heretic, the Rambam says. And the Rambam adds, and you are makhish magideha, you deny the tellers of Torah. Isn't that redundant? Isn't the Torah Shebaal Peh given through the people who tell it? So Rav Soloveitchik says, no, the Rambam is precise. You have to believe in the chain of tradition in addition to the facts of tradition. There is a value to the people themselves, not just to the actual content that's being passed along. And that's why he says, I told this to my father, that there is a concept of Mesorah that rests on these people that we need to look to from generation to generation. Yeah, Glenn.
So does that explain then the rise of the Machlokan itself, because there was not that clear chain, it could have gone two ways?
So that's an interesting question. What about, how does Machlokas fit in this? So the Rambam, Rav Soloveitchik, will say that even though there was Machlokas, but at the end of the day, there had to be one person who was the bearer of the tradition in general. And that person would incorporate within themselves the different varying opinions. And that's going to continue every generation. So if you go back to the list, let's say Rav and Shmuel were designated as Balei HaMesorah. And as part of our tradition, we have to accept the fact that they were the authoritative figures of that generation of what is the Mesorah. But it doesn't mean that they didn't have differences of opinion. So then you're going to have to go back and try to figure out, well, let's say, for example, if you're taking Rav and Shmuel, so Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda would argue about a view that Rav and Shmuel had. So the Machlokas is existing within the tradition of the Mesorah. So Rav Soloveitchik, in 1944, said, we have to know who these people are. The Rambam told us we have to know who they are. So now I want to conclude with one more observation for Rav Soloveitchik in a different context, which is, now that we know it's important to know them, so that we know, number one, that there's credibility here, but number two, that they have a halachic status that we revere as the conduits, the chaloshim of the Balei HaMesorah, so then the question becomes in the reverse. So why don't we know who they are? Why don't we know what Rob ate for breakfast? And why don't we know what Pinchas did for a living? And why don't we know about Tzfanya's, you know, his background, what his life is about? Why don't we know more about these people if it's so important that we know these people? So Rav Soloveitchik, in a different place, addressed this question. This is the collection of essays called Halachic Morality, Essays on Ethics and Mesorah. It's an amazing volume. And these were lectures that Rav Soloveitchik gave, which he wrote down in manuscript form, and then the Torah Sarab Foundation, they've been editing these over the different years. And this particular one that we're focusing on today was a manuscript of a course that Rav Soloveitchik gave in Revel, in the Bernard Revel Graduate School in the early 1950s on Pirkei Avos. And so Rav Soloveitchik addresses this question, and now take a look at the orange page. It's here in classic Brisker form. Remember we said that oftentimes in the world of Brisk, they break things down into two, so you don't have this on your page, but this is a subsection of the first essay. The essay is called From Sinai to the Men of the Great Assembly. It's called Anonymity and Community. Two dinim. So he says, these Balei HaMesorah that we are talking about, they have two aspects of it. So let's go to page side A, You see where it is, side A on your orange sheets? Side A. Here, Rav Soloveitchik is in the context of, which we obviously were way over time already, so I'll try not to be marech too much, but I want to give it its due. He's talking in general about the role of humanity and individuals vis-a-vis the community. On the one hand, in Judaism, people are alone, they are lonely, they are solitary. On the other hand, they're part of a community. It's not that a person is only alone. It's not Robinson Crusoe, make it on your own and build a community out of utilitarian purpose. But it's also not, you know, I'm a nothing, it's all about the community. It's both. So in that context, which it's an awesome essay to read, we can explore at a different time. In that context, Rav Soloveitchik addresses our issue. The Masorah has indeed reckoned with this ambivalent relationship between individual and community. The passing on of the oral law is, as I emphasized above, not a technical gesture. It implies more than that. It spells fellowship and personal union, the commitment and total dedication of the many to a single purpose. The Chachmei HaMasorah formed a community, not only in a sociological sense, but also within a higher order, a community of the committed, of those who personify the Torah Aidos, who carry the historic and meta-historical burden of Masorah, who try to abandon the barriers of the uniqueness and inapproachability and blend into one Masorah community their talents, thoughts, and feelings. In a word, their personal experiences. Of course, they could not make that miraculous leap from complete loneliness to full communal beings, since it is both undesirable and impossible. And they returned from time to time to their lonely existences, retreated into themselves, into their mysterious realms of absolute aloneness and inwardness. Chachmei HaMasorah have been engaged in a double movement. On the one hand, toward the outside, breaking through the hidden introspective personality and its segregating barrier of individualism, toward uniting with others through self-expression, self-revelation, and incursion into new extension and new existential realms. And on the other hand, the backwards movement to the tranquil of a hermit-like mono-existence whose only companion is God, the flight of the lonely one to the lonely one. Each Chacham HaMasorah gives part of himself to others, yet cannot succeed in giving himself up completely. Turn the page over, side view. I'm skipping the example he gives from Moshe. But left column. Therefore, we encounter in the annals of the Masorah something paradoxical, the lack of biographical data. We know almost nothing about the men of the Great Assembly. The whole institution is shrouded in mystery and anonymity. What is history recorded of the great lives of the other Chachmei HaMasorah, of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, of Rabbeinu HaGadol, of Rav, of Shmuel, of Rashi? Our knowledge consists of fragmentary details that have reached us incidentally, mostly in connection with the passing of halachic material. Next column, right side. The reason for this peculiar treatment accorded the individual is clear. Under whatever aspect we would consider his life, either the aspect of complete surrender and commitment to the community or that of the unaffected lonely self, there is no need to take public note of him. As a member of the community, he submerges himself in it. Self-effacement is the appropriate attitude on the part of the Chacham HaMasorah. He is servant to this people, and in this role, the scholar cannot pretend to be a central figure or claim historical gratitude. This service is accepted like the service of a soldier. Interesting analogy. The service of a soldier. His name remains unknown forever. Important is the scholar as a bearer of eternal truths. And as such, he has joined the community of the committed and disappear in it. The historic continuum is relevant. The singular facets and dimensions are not. He has given away to his disciple. On the other hand, the scholar as an individual, a self, a lonely being who can never redeem himself from his strangeness in the world of coexistence, he is outside the Masorah community and hence holds no interest to us. Within the peculiar order of uniqueness, in the eternal flight from loneliness to the lonely one, man finds himself outside historical existence and therefore does not lend himself to historical recording. So we need to know these people. We need to know who they were. But says Rav Soloveitchik, we need to know them in the context of the historical narrative. We need to know them as a chaloshim Torah Sheba'al Peh, as the people who play a crucial role in ensuring and also creating what is the tradition. But if that's their role, what they ate for breakfast really wasn't important. Rav Soloveitchik really would not want us to know whether he wore single-breasted or double-breasted suits, because that's not really significant for us. What's significant is the fact that he was a Bala Masorah. Obviously, he's not certified by the Rambam. And the contribution to this community of Masorah that's transcending generations, that now connects us back to Moshe Rabbeinu, that's what's important. So we have to know who they were to understand their contributions and their historical context in the role of the Chachmei HaMasorah as part of the giant historical narrative. So where did we start? We started on the blue page. That's why, obviously, I'm not going to put my name on there. That's ludicrous because I'm not from the Chachmei HaMasorah. But we know people who are part of that Chachmei HaMasorah. And when we look at the whole arc, we can see the significance. We need to know their names and know their place in history to know that there is a chain of tradition and that they are part, not just of maintaining the actual tradition, but they're part of the design of tradition, that it has to be a teacher and a student. And it has to be people who devote their life wholly and completely to this task. And therefore, they are prepared to recede into anonymity so that the story is not about them as people, but it's about the Torah that they are passing on. That's really what's important. Yes. Okay.
You said
that
Rabbi Soloveitchik, somebody else is saying Saturday.
Good! And that's why it's important. Everybody should make sure they have their own blue chart. If you look in Chassidish communities, they'll have a different end. If you look at Sephardic communities, they'll have a whole different third column. But they all are part of the general Talich HaMasorah. Now, Rabbi Neumann is correct. The Bale HaMasorah, as we refer to them today, are not the Bale HaMasorah with a capital H that were in the time of the Talmud. Ravina Ravashi or Sofer Ra. And even the Vilna Gaon. You know, Rav Moshe will argue with the Vilna Gaon. It's not the same level, but the idea that there is this Masorah, even though it doesn't have the same authority today, I think it's very significant. If you talk about Masorah, you need to know that this is the narrative that we're talking about. Yashikoach!
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Another way, according to...